Hello and welcome to the Spectator podcast. I'm Lara Prendergast, and on this week's episode, we'll be asking whether prostitution can ever be empowering. We'll also be looking at the wide open race to be the next Tory leader. And finally, we'll be considering whether British universities need to become more elitist. Prostitution, or sex work, has come to be seen as a choice, one which can even empower women. But as Julie Bindle says in this week's issue of the magazine, this is a myth. In fact, prostitution is still one of the worst forms of abuse going on in the UK, and it must be addressed as part of the fight against modern slavery. Julie joins me now, along with Rachel Moran, a women's rights activist and the author of Paid For, My Journey Through Prostitution. So Julie, you've spent the past few years researching your book, The Pimping of Prostitution. What did you discover?
This is a topic that I've looked at in the kind of realm of violence against women for decades. But what I wanted to do in researching the book was to see how the pro-prostitution lobby, the lobby that is prevalent around the world and very well funded, presents its argument to the person on the street. So, for example, if you go outside now and ask a passerby, what do you think we should do about prostitution? Because everybody knows that there are problems related to it. They will tell you legalise it. They will tell you that it will make it safer for the girls, that it will bring it above board, and that anything else would be a disaster. Now, they don't know anything about the sex trade, the people that you stop. I'm just assuming that they're kind of lay people who've never been involved in it and who aren't politicians or policymakers. But the reason why they would say that, as opposed to what I would say and the other feminist abolitionists would say, which is you should try to eradicate it, is because they have been fed this guff in the form of persuasive mythology for decades upon decades by those that seek to profit from the sex trade, because it's a commercial venture bringing in billions of dollars worldwide. And also because most people just can't get their head around the fact that men's penises will not shrivel up and die if they don't have access to the kind of sex that they want, when they want it, with whom they want.
Rachel, what do you make of this term, sex worker?
I think it's preposterous. I think it's blatantly Orwellian. I spent 7 years in the sex trade and I never met a woman who referred to herself as a sex worker. I think it's deliberately constructed. I think its purpose is to sanitise and normalise the sex trade. I just have utter contempt for the term.
Julie, during your research, did you meet anyone who called themselves a sex worker or who indeed thought that sex work was liberating?
Yes, I did. It's what some of the survivors that I interviewed, and I interviewed 50 survivors of the sex trade, refer to as the 1% or the privileged minority. And as you know, we don't ever base laws or policy on a tiny minority. So I met women who said that they were sex workers, and some of those, not all of them, but some of those were actually pimps. Because the term sex worker, even by their own definition, and I mean their as being the pro-prostitution lobby, includes pornographers, it includes pimps, brothel owners, because anyone who works in the business of sex, they say, is a sex worker. Now, when these women told me, as some did, that they found sex work to be no more abusive than working in McDonald's or any kind of other low-paid, unskilled job, the words of one of the survivors who started off the modern feminist abolitionist movement, Evelina Giobbe, who's an American feminist, said to me, she said that if you work in McDonald's, you know, that's one thing, but at least when you work at McDonald's, you're not the meat like you are in prostitution. So the key point that Evelina was making, and that the survivors that I met, whether they're in Cambodia or Vancouver in Canada, was that women are the commodity. In journalism, for example, I sell my skills. In factories, you sell your labour. With prostitution, you are the actual commodity. You're not the thing that you're helping to make on the production line. And you're not the article at the end of your busy day. But you are the thing. And that's how prostitution is.
Rachel, how much do you think that this idea of a sex worker is just a way or a term rather making men feel better about visiting a prostitute?
I think that the whole purpose of the term was to obscure the reality of what's going on behind it. And I think that that's one of the elements, of course, because you're obscuring it for everybody, aren't you? But I think that what we're really looking at here is a global human rights violation that's been rolling on for millennia. And the modern push that's been going on since around the 80s is to very deliberately designed to keep us looking the other way. That's what the term sex work does.
Julie, in your piece you mentioned this fairly horrible quote from someone who says to you that it's no different from buying a burger when you're starving and the wife hasn't cooked you anything. Do men see women as liberated working in the prostitution trade, or do they see them as sexual slaves?
The men who buy women care neither way. I mean, there are some men who will go out to brothels looking specifically for women in servitude, for looking specifically for women who cannot speak a word of English or who are scared. That turns them on. They're sadists. The majority of men that I've interviewed, and that certainly my abolitionist colleagues like Rachel who've survived the sex trade tell me, is that they just want to have sex when they want it, with whom they want it, how they want it. So there's that horrible, horrible so-called joke that many men use down the pub, which is, I'm not paying her for sex, I'm paying her to not talk to me afterwards and to leave afterwards. Now that to me says it all, because what these men want, the sex buyers, some of whom are perfectly nice chaps, some of whom have, you know, a lot of them are very personable, could get a real date. What they actually want is a woman to do whatever they wish to them. Now the thing about the prostitution contract that I understand from the interviews that I've done, from the men and from the survivors and from many other people, is that only one half of this transaction is consenting. So when we talk about the sex workers' rights lobby and their argument of, we want to do this, how dare you feminists tell us when and with whom we can have sex? How dare you take away the right for us to consent to say yes to being a sex worker? I'm always minded of the men who make it very plain that if they didn't pay the woman, and they know this, she wouldn't have sex with him. Now, what else do we call that? Sex where only one person is consenting? There's another word for it, isn't there?
At the moment, we're also hearing a lot, obviously, about this modern slavery bill, which Theresa May is focusing on. Do you think that the sex trade should be the main focus of that bill?
Well, I have two thoughts about that. One is that it's actually not useful in a way to focus on the slavery aspects of prostitution, because many people, the pro-prostitution lobby, Amnesty International and all the other leftist liberal big guns who seem to think that this is a right for men and a liberation for women, what they will take from that is we should only focus on the women who are enslaved, technically speaking, as far as they're concerned, who are locked in the back of a transit van, brought over from Moldova to the UK, then chained to a radiator in a brothel and forced. People will always be sympathetic about that. Politicians and policymakers will always say, we need to outlaw that, it's terrible. That's what most people mean and think about when they use the term trafficking. Now, if we look back at the slave trade, we know that the vast majority of people who were enslaved were not shackled to anything. They were not forced, they were not tied up. They had no other choice, they couldn't get out. They had no other option, they'd been dehumanised. And so actually, trafficking and prostitution, they're both indivisible terms. Women do not have to be chained to a radiator to be enslaved. The enslavement bit is patriarchy, it's male oppression. It's the fact that men will decide how and where we are liberated, and it's on their terms always. So modern slavery, well, prostitution and the sex trade has been enslaving women, all women, from the beginning of time, because obviously all women are affected by prostitution, because if men think that they can rent an orifice from a woman and that there are some women who are worth nothing other than to be orifices for men's sexual release, this affects the status of all women.
Rachel, is there any country you think Britain should be looking at who has a better approach than we do at the moment?
Absolutely. The model that we promote is the abolitionist model. It began its life as the Swedish model in, of course, Sweden, then became known as the Nordic model as it moved into Norway and Iceland. At this point, we're referring to it as the abolitionist model because it's since moved into Ireland, North and the Republic in two separate processes, obviously, and into France. And it's currently being looked at in the Israeli Knesset. So I absolutely think that France has adopted the model in a way that is more comprehensive and thorough than anywhere else to date. So I think that the UK certainly ought to be looking at France.
And Rachel, what exactly is the abolitionist model?
It's the model that quite simply criminalises the demand for paid sexual access to human beings. So it's a gender neutral law. So that if I, as a woman, were to pay to sexually access a man's body or anyone else's, I would be just as criminally liable. And it also introduces exit strategies. So that's help and support around education, training, housing, childcare, addiction services, all of the array of supports that women and people more generally need in order to get out of the sex trade. And it also crucially decriminalises the act of selling sexual access to one's own body, because that is criminal legislation that has existed since forever in so many places, and it is in and of itself a human rights violation.
Julie, just finally, in your piece you mentioned you met this woman who came up with the term happy hooker. Do you think that's a complete myth, that there is such a thing as a happy hooker?
I think the term happy hooker is as much of a myth as the British-born black man who tells me that he's never experienced any racism at all in his entire life. I think that somewhere he exists, but he is atypical and he doesn't represent, and nor should he ever represent, the black British community or the anti-racist struggle. But I want to say one thing about the person on the street that we spoke about earlier, the lay person who knows nothing about this topic, but always think that they do, because everybody's got an opinion on prostitution. What the majority of people don't realise, and I'm not being patronising here, is what they've been subliminally fed from the pimp lobby, from the lobby that earns billions from this trade. They have been told that this isn't a form of abuse for women and girls, like domestic violence and rape and FGM and forced marriage. They've been told it's something that's good for women. And the reason why they are so embedded and keen on this mythology is because they have a much louder voice than the abolitionists, than those who are anti-prostitution, for good reason, for human rights reasons, not for crazy anti-sex religious reasons. And they honestly believe that legalisation will bring this trade from underground, and that it will get it into a position where it can be properly regulated. It has been tried over and over again in countries like Holland, in Germany, in New Zealand, in Australia, etc. And it has been an unmitigated disaster. What we need to do now is accept that men will not be harmed at all if they are prevented from paying for sex, just like the people who've been prevented from smoking in public will not be harmed. We need to legislate against the demand, and we need to stop pretending that legalisation or decriminalisation will ever help anyone but the pimps and the sex buyers.
That was Julie Bindle and Rachel Moran.
Hello, I'm Sam Leith, literary editor of The Spectator, and I present the weekly books podcast, at which you'll hear lively discussions from the best and most interesting critics and writers and authors out there, from Charlotte Rampling to Daniel Dennett, all the way past to Michael Morpurgo. I very much hope you'll give us a try. Just search for Spectator Books on the iTunes store.
In her political column this week, Katie Balls describes the ongoing phony Tory leadership contest. Katie joins me now, along with Paul Goodman, the editor of Conservative Home. So, Katie, we learned from your piece that parliamentary private secretaries are being asked to report anyone who might be looking to run for the leadership. Is it fair to say there's a slightly paranoid atmosphere in Westminster at the moment?
Yes, I think that's fair. What's happened is a consensus has been formed that the plan is to keep Theresa May in post till the end of the Brexit negotiations. There was a time shortly after the result of the snap election that people thought about ousting her. But as time has gone on, every alternative to May has seemed a lot worse, a lot more complicated. So a lot of backbenchers, and we saw this with the 1922 committee before recess, have said that they want May to stay. And that means that there isn't going to be a leadership contest. But naturally, you can't actually stop ambitious Tories from plotting. So what we have forming is this kind of phony Tory leadership contest.
And Paul, what do you make of the phony Tory leadership war?
It's quite a good title for Katie's piece, because, of course, the phony war in the Second World War did eventually turn into the real war. So this boxing and coxing for a leadership election will probably turn into something real. So maybe we'll all be proved wrong again, just as David Cameron was re-elected and the British people voted Leave and Jeremy Corbyn got 40%. Maybe Theresa May will stay on and we'll find her leading the Tories into the 2022 election. But on the whole, it's unlikely. On the whole, it's now expected that she'll go after the Brexit negotiation in 2019, which raises the question of what will happen next. And I think a kind of important point here is that something like two-thirds of the parliamentary party was now elected in 2010 or afterwards. And they think the older generation, a lot of them think the older generation has messed up. They look at Theresa May and David Davis and Philip Hammond and so on, and they think these are the people who are in charge of an election that went wrong. And these are also the people who, in one way or another, are very associated with the divisive Brexit campaign. So maybe we should be looking at someone a bit younger, as people turn to David Cameron in 2005, rather than the person now near the centre of the action, David Davis.
Katie, do you think that's fair, that there's a sense that the older generation are slightly past their sell-by date?
Definitely there's a feeling that the old guard aren't the answer to the current problem. You look at Brexit, where they think, you know, there's been lots of confusion in recent months in terms of the negotiations. You look to the election campaign, where they don't think there was enough of a positive message. And then you go more recently to all these cabinet squabbles we've had. And that has really angered the backbench MPs, the younger MPs. They think the cabinet are not leading by example. If they're not leading by example, why should you listen to them? One backbencher said to me that cabinet has become increasingly detached from the rest of the party. And that means they're starting to look around at the younger group to see who could maybe be that new face. But the problem is, they're not looking for a new Tory leader here. They're looking for a new prime minister. So the idea of putting someone in who doesn't have much ministerial experience, let alone someone straight off the backbench, is quite unthinkable.
Paul, who would you be keeping your eye on in terms of the old guard and the new guard?
Quite a lot depends on what happens if Theresa May does a reshuffle before 2019. Because I think Katie's right. It gets very hard for someone to emerge as a future leader if they're not actually in cabinet, or at least a very prominent senior minister. So you've got to look at who she promotes. And one of the instincts of the whips will be not to make many promotions of that kind, because making all that change could upset the apple cart in a very delicately balanced parliament where no one's got a majority. On the other hand, it would be very good for the party if some of these younger people who apparently may want to stand could ventilate their ideas so we all know what they want to do. In her piece, she names Rory Stewart and Dominic Raab. It'll be, you know, interesting to see if Theresa May promotes either of them to cabinet in the next few years.
And what do you make of Jacob Rees-Mogg's ambitions?
Well, Jacob, of course, unlike Rory Stewart, unlike Dominic Raab, is not a minister. And, you know, he himself has said that he doesn't see how he could come from the backbenches to be prime minister. But you've got to think that he thinks he's being flattered. He did quite well in a YouGov poll of party activists. He did extremely well in our last Conservative Home survey, where he was written in a second. So there's quite a bit of evidence that he's becoming a kind of Corbyn figure. You know, Tory activists are looking for something that's authentic and that can kind of inspire younger people. But as I say, I think he himself thinks he can't make the jump, but he probably is thinking now that he's going to get a bit of a place in the sun and that maybe he'll be offered a sort of proper senior ministerial job.
Yeah, and I think the thing with Jacob Rees-Mogg is he's not actually playing by the rules of this phony Tory leadership contest. Because the whole thing is, you're not supposed to be seen to be posturing, preening or parading in public. You're not supposed to be seen as though you were even considering being leader. Rees-Mogg doesn't have these qualms, much to the annoyance of his colleagues, has taken many media appearances this week where he has modestly explained why he might not be a great leader, which has obviously only poured petrol on the claims. So I think that suggests that he doesn't actually have a serious plan to become prime minister. But leadership talk can only help you when it comes to getting a government role, and which might be something Number 10 have to start thinking about.
Paul, let's think theoretically, someone was to go from being a minister into the cabinet and to then become prime minister. Are they going to be up to the job of dealing with all the Brexit negotiations?
Well, this is what we don't know. I mean, I think quite a lot of these people have looked back at the David Cameron experience and thought, he was only in the Commons for 4 years and became leader. If he can do it, so can I. But for all the hunger for a sort of younger person, in some cases among the membership for a sort of Rees-Mogg figure or for someone who's very different, Ruth Davidson, I don't think there's any agreement on who this person is. You know, who is this paragon outsider who's going to come along and be so much better than these people at the top, who's going to be fresh but can deal with all the media attention, who's going to have no long-standing experience of government but is going to be able to manage the Brexit negotiations. I'm not sure at the moment that such a person exists. And one of the things we may find out in the next few years is whether he or she does.
Yeah, and in the piece, I mentioned a Tory MP who was explaining to me the current situation. And they said that it's fine because they now have a plan. They were a bit worried at the start because they were like, what the hell is the plan? They're like, we have a plan, 18 months of May, and then we're going to come up with a plan. So there's a lot of wishful thinking going on here. I think a lot of the Tories are just thinking if they wait 2 years, public mood might change and it might suddenly become obvious who the candidate is and things might get easier. But that is quite unlikely.
Just finally, Paul, how do you think this is all going to play out at Tory party conference?
I think, first of all, there will be all the usual media speculation about whether or not there will be a putsch against Theresa May in October. That's probably rather unlikely. But I think a lot of these characters would want to push the boat out a bit and might well feel that Downing Street's not got the muscle with a no majority to be able to stop them. So in our survey, we named 11 people, 11 potential runners, and I put on an addendum to say we could have named another 15. Gavin Williamson, Brandon Lewis, all these names, James Cleverly, his backbencher, all these names have been floated around and none of them, as far as I know, have denied it. So I think at conferences you see an awful lot of people trying to further their cause and say, this is my idea of what conservatism is. It should be very interesting. So the challenge for the whips and for Downing Street will be to sort of get through that week without noises off that sink the boat, if I can really mix a metaphor.
That was Katie Balls and Paul Goodman. Why wait for tomorrow's papers? The best analysis of the day's news is already on Coffee House. To subscribe to the Evening Blend email in order to receive the best of The Spectator each day, just head to spectator.co.uk/blend. In this week's issue of the magazine, the university academic Ashley Whittle says that to survive, universities need to become elitist once again. I'm now joined by the novelist Tiwa Fisher, who recently wrote a piece for The Telegraph which claimed that university students he teaches are moaning illiterate snowflakes, and Jake Kerfer, a recent graduate who's currently interning at The Spectator. So Tiwa, in your piece, you describe how the undergraduates you teach are incapable of writing a correct sentence. How do you think it's come to this?
Well, let me start off by saying that The Telegraph were a little bit naughty with their somewhat provocative strapline, because I didn't actually say students were snowflakes or moaners. The point I was making is that standards have fallen very low, and it's not an uncommon thing for you to come across a student who is simply incapable of writing a correct, coherent sentence in English, either spelling or punctuation or grammar. Or if they get over those hurdles, then you just get sentences which are sort of nonsense, such as, you know, these differences show that there are differences. And the students who are that, you know, these are the extreme cases, and there aren't very many people like that. It's a very small percentage. I don't know, 1%, 2%, 3%, whatever. But they are there. They've got to university. And of course, you know, they face a hopeless task because they can't possibly catch up, you know, if they're doing a literature degree. I mean, I taught English literature and creative writing. Those are the areas I worked in, so that's what I know about. But then you have a sort of much larger group of students who aren't much more literate, who can sort of knock out a basic sentence, but then have problems putting those sentences into paragraphs or an essay. And the problem seems to lie in the schools, where people seem to be able to drift through without really being asked to do anything. And when I sort of suggest to some students that they should, you know, print out their work and check it before they hand it in, you can see it comes as a revelation to some of them that this is what you have to do.
Jake, is this something that you recognise?
I think there's definitely an issue that people perhaps don't pay as much attention to language and punctuation the way they used to. I'm sort of not that long out of school myself, and we don't spend that much time looking at grammar and spelling. But I don't think it undermines the ideas people bring to university. People fundamentally aren't there to write something is perfect in terms of punctuation and grammar. If they can bring some ideas and something new or something exciting, that's more valuable than getting the spelling correct on a complicated word. And the university is there to challenge, there to stimulate, it isn't there to create a lot of grammar robots. And that's what's more important, is people, even if they don't structure it properly, if they bring something interesting and fresh, that's definitely worth a university education, however they express that.
Well, I completely disagree with that. One. Two, part of the problem is not that, you know, people aren't very concerned with grammar and spelling. There seem to be at least a couple of generations who've got through the system without knowing any grammar or punctuation. That's part of the problem. And secondly, I find you do get people who, like you, argue that this stuff isn't that important. Funnily enough, I tend to find they're the people who don't write very well. And if you don't know a lot about grammar and punctuation and you're a physicist or a mathematician, I think that's a pity, but you can get away with it. If you cannot express yourself clearly and coherently, you know, you don't know what you're talking about. The limits of your language and the use of the language is, to a large extent, the limits of you.
But that's referring to written communication. You've also got verbal communication, which is very important. You know, just because someone can't put their words to paper doesn't mean they're not intelligent. You have people with dyslexia who have medical conditions, means they cannot write particularly well. That doesn't mean they haven't got ideas they can verbally express. I think you're sort of bringing two things together.
I'm not saying that people can't verbally express. But university, a literature degree, is precisely about that. If you can express something verbally clearly, then I don't see why you can't put it down on paper clearly.
Surely, Jake, if you're going to be studying English literature at university, you should have, or at least arrive with, a basic grasp of English grammar.
I think a grasp, but again, I think a literature degree is more about understanding. If you want to,
yes,
again,
if you don't,
an English language degree.
If you don't understand, you know, how sentences work, how can you appreciate literature? How can you understand how writers work? I mean, as I say, in some areas of study, it's not such a big problem. But if you are a literature student, and the other thing about, again, the people who do English literature who turn up, is many of them actually are very resistant to reading full stop. I mean, they get quite indignant and resentful when you ask them to read a short story. I mean, I think part of the problem, certainly with English literature, is that it has always been a sort of default subject for people who don't really want to work too hard or don't really know what they want to do, so they opt for English.
I can't comment on why people do English. I didn't study it myself.
Do you, in your piece, you also mentioned the fear of repercussions that academics feel. Do you think academics are becoming more scared of bringing up students on issues such
as
grammar?
Well, I am right in thinking that the person who wrote the piece for, you know, your current issue is writing under a pseudonym.
Yeah.
Why is that, I might ask?
Well, I think it's because, like you say, he is slightly scared of what might happen.
What I'm saying is really news to anyone in the university world. The problem is the management at universities are paid to sort of say everything is hunky-dory. And the people who are down at the coalface, who are well aware of these problems, you know, and I taught at Brunel, I taught at Canterbury Christ Church, I taught at Goldsmiths, City and Guilds Art School. This is, you know, this is not news to anyone who actually lectures, but, you know, they can't really make a fuss about it because they have kids in the mortgage. They have to go along with the system.
Jake, in 5 years, as the piece describes, the proportion of firsts has risen from 17% to 24%. Do you think students are getting cleverer, or do you think grades are getting easier to achieve?
Grades going up, like grades are getting easier, but that's because education's becoming a commodity. We're not educating people for the love of learning anymore. Instead, it's something they pay their night brand fees. Universities are selling a product, and it, much like in 2008 with the banking crash, the rating agencies rated things well even when they were dodgy because they wanted to make money. Universities grade people well because they want people to go there and make money.
Well, I completely agree with you. I mean, the basic problem is the bums on seats policy that all universities now are concerned with getting as many students as they can. And this leads to the other problem, that they don't like to fail people. It's pretty much impossible to fail your degree. I mean, if you actually turn up and hand something in, you're going to pass. I mean, perhaps an individual essay will be failed, but then you can resit, resubmit, get around it somehow. So that's another major problem. And I think, you know, it's not just the lecturers who may be concerned about it. I think actually the students who do get a first or a 2-1, are slightly annoyed by the fact that the whole degree is being slightly devalued by the fact that, you know, there are people who do almost nothing and who will still emerge with a degree.
Jake, what was your degree and do you think it was worth it?
So I did PPE. I think it's definitely worth it. It's opened doors that wouldn't be open otherwise. Sort of, I'm in the best part of 50 grand's worth of debt as a result of that. But I think even after repaying that, I'll have access to earnings. That's opportunities I never would have had if I hadn't taken that degree.
And T, just finally, do you think that grades have been devalued?
Well, not necessarily. I mean, I think the people who get the top grades have done some work. I mean, I think that's still true because there are plenty of students who are motivated and who take the degree course seriously. As I say, the problem is that you can sort of scrape through by doing almost nothing, and that does sort of devalue the degree as a whole. And also, again, you know, that I think a lot of people, a generation of students, have been missold university on the basis that go to university and you will have a better life, not that, you know, you will be intellectually enriched. And I'm afraid a lot of the people who graduate won't get well-paid jobs and won't be able to pay back their student debt.
That was Tibor Fisher and Jake Herford. That's all for this week. You can subscribe to the podcast on the iTunes store or by visiting spectator.co.uk/podcast. And you can also subscribe to our other shows, including Americano, our American politics podcast hosted by Freddie Gray. And if you enjoy the podcasts, why not pick up the magazine? You can read all the features discussed, as well as great pieces by Paul Wood, Chris Mullen, and Francis Wilson. And we've got a special offer for podcast listeners. Get 12 issues for just £12, as well as a limited edition Spectator Moleskine notebook, if you subscribe at spectator.co.uk/pod offer. Thanks for listening, and do join us again next week.